From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, execution day is nearing for death row inmate Rodney Reed. His lawyer tells us DNA could clear his name. Rural hospitals are on life support, and it's killing Texans who depend on them. And a growing number of Texans can't pay back their student loans. This is Texas Matters. From Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. On November 20th, Rodney Reed is scheduled to be executed in Texas. He was convicted of raping and killing 19-year-old Stacy Stites in 1996 in Bastrop County. Reed says they were in a consensual relationship and maintains his innocence. A growing number of celebrities and lawmakers are calling on Governor Greg Abbott to step in and delay the execution while DNA evidence is tested. Bryce Benjet is Reed's attorney, and he works for the Innocence Project.
Certainly, we are approaching the execution. We have filed a clemency application with the Board of Pardons and Parole and have asked the governor for a reprieve. We have also filed stay motions in the state court as well as in the United States Supreme Court. We have a petition with the United States Supreme Court raising actual innocence and a number of constitutional violations. And we will be filing in the next few days additional appeals both in state and federal court based on new evidence. This is who we have discovered who establish both that Jimmy Finnell confessed to the murder of Stacy Stites and that he said that he knew about a relationship with Rodney and Stacy. This is really a flurry of activity that is going on, and unfortunately, we've been forced to do all of this in a very compressed time frame because the state, without consulting with us or considering the courts, set a very expedited execution date.
This has become a celebrity-driven story as well. People like Oprah and Kim Kardashian have become involved in this. Has that given you any more sway in trying to get some sort of attention on these appeals?
This is a fact-driven case in which there are hard scientific facts that show that Rodney Reed could not have committed the crime. Now, anybody who looks at these facts is going to realize that this is a problem and then we can't go forward with the execution. And so the extraordinary attention that has come, I think, is coming from the fact that nobody should want to execute a person who didn't commit the crime. And so I think that, yes, the celebrity folks who have weighed in, whether it's Dr. Phil or Oprah or Kim Kardashian or any number of folks, are no different than the 26 state representatives who have weighed in. You know, 13 Democrats, 13 Republicans. Obviously, we're encouraged by all of this attention, but I don't think that it's fair to consider this to be a celebrity-driven campaign whatsoever. I think it is a fact-driven campaign, and that the compelling facts of this case command action.
People are calling on Governor Greg Abbott to step in. However, the governor of Texas doesn't have that much power when it comes to stopping executions in Texas. He doesn't have that phone and he can't, you know, immediately, you know, like we see in the old movies. But he can offer, what, a delay? What can he do?
So the governor on his own can issue what's called a 30-day reprieve. And we've certainly asked for that. We've presented substantial evidence of innocence, the Board of Pardons and Paroles, which makes a recommendation to the governor. And so we are certainly hoping that the Pardons and Paroles will recommend greater relief than what the governor could give just unilaterally. We've asked for the Board of Pardons and Paroles to recommend a commutation of the sentence, which would, in their discretion, reduce the sentence from death to either life or a term of years. And I've talked to Rodney about this, and he does not want a pardon. He does not want to be released by fiat. He wants to be vindicated in the courts. And so obviously we cannot do that if the state is trying to execute him. But certainly what his desire is that the death penalty is taken off the table so that courts can look at this in orderly way.
There's DNA in this appeal. I mean, how much DNA is there? Why hasn't it been tested? Why don't they test it now? Why do they refuse to test it?
Well, I can't really respond to why a prosecutor who is trying to execute a man would refuse to do DNA testing. That just is unfathomable to me. It makes no sense. We have asked to test a number of items that are capable of identifying the murderer. And at every turn, the state of Texas has refused.
One argument that I've read is that the prosecution says it's been so long that the DNA evidence is probably contaminated and that it would not be useful in testing it at this point.
We work on, you know, at the Innocence Project, my main work is DNA testing. And we work on cases that are decades old all around the country all the time. The good thing about DNA testing is that it can actually identify the source of the evidence. And so if there's some question about whether a juror's DNA or a court reporter's DNA might be on the item, we'll identify that person. But we can also identify the killer. And so, again, it simply makes no sense when you're trying to execute a person that would not do this very basic forensic technique that can identify the killer. And I don't want to make this case all about DNA because it's not. There is hard scientific evidence that the state has known about for years, and they have never contradicted it, that show that Rodney Reed's guilt is impossible. And everything of this case points to Jimmy Finnell. The forensic evidence shows that Stacey Seitz was murdered at a time that Finnell testified he was alone with her in their apartment. All of these witnesses that we've seen just even in the last few months have all coming forward with information implicating Jimmy Finnell. And these are not people just off the street. These are police officers.
The problem of appeals at this point, as far as I understand it, is trying to prove actual innocence or establish actual innocence is very difficult, and it may not even be something that a court is willing to even entertain. Is that a problem, especially when you get to the level of the Supreme Court?
Well, so there is an open question in federal constitutional law as to whether actual innocence on its own is a constitutional violation. But this trial that resulted in Rodney Reed's conviction and death sentence was a train wreck. And there is constitutional error plenty to go around. And so I don't think that that will be an issue for the courts. I think that when we present all of this evidence in a fair way, this execution just can't be afforded.
Bryce Benjet is an attorney for the Innocence Project and is representing Rodney Reed, who was convicted of raping and killing Stacey Seitz. He is due for execution on November 20th. We have an update on another death row case that we've been following on Texas Matters, Texas 7 member Patrick Murphy. Murphy was set to be executed on November 13th. But on Thursday, his execution was again halted over his religious freedom. He is a Buddhist. I spoke to Murphy in April after this issue first came to light.
Well, my first reaction was that I kind of covered my face like with my hands like so and turned. I said, oh, thank you. And I turned and I did weep a little bit. And then after that, my emotional state was pretty much turmoil. You know, I was kind of in shock. Because I really wasn't expecting it.
What was the demeanor of the warden when he told you that you had to stay? Was it just a straightforward matter of fact?
Just, you know, very straightforward matter of fact. The men who work the death house there at Huntsville are very professional, very professional, very respectful officers, and they take that job very seriously because they are dealing with death. And they try to be very respectful.
you were granted the stay because of a freedom of religion issue.
Yes, sir.
That you had requested that a Buddhist chaplain would be your spiritual advisor in the death chamber at the time of your execution, and then because that was denied, and the Supreme Court said this is a case of religious discrimination.
Yes, sir.
What does that mean to you?
Well, up until January or the 1st of February, I didn't even realize that this was an issue. As far as the religious freedom and things like that, I think it's very important because, you know, Texas more or less prides itself at being part of the Bible Belt and being a very religious state. So if they're going to recognize one religion, then I think they should be recognize all of them.
On Thursday, a U.S. district judge wrote in his stay that Murphy had demonstrated a valid concern about the Texas Department of Criminal Justice execution policy. Murphy is on death row for his role in the infamous Texas 7 prison escape that resulted in the murder of Irving police officer Aubrey Hawkins. For many of the approximately 3 million Texans living outside of the state's major metropolitan areas, when there is a medical emergency, they're finding fewer and fewer places to turn to for help. Texas rural hospitals are in trouble. Many have closed, and more are looking to shutter their doors. Sophie Novak writes about it for the Texas Observer in an article titled, "A Dying Town. When a Rural Hospital Dies, the Town Around It Follows Suit."
For a number of years now, we're seeing rural hospitals close. It's in large part, you know, dwindling populations in rural areas can't support a hospital anymore. Cuts to Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement rates have really hurt hospitals' bottom lines. And then there's a burden of caring for uninsured folks at rural hospitals that a lot of the times these facilities just can't make ends meet. And so this is a problem across the U.S., but it's worst in Texas. So in Texas, we have the most rural hospital closures of any state. It's nearly double any other state. We've seen about 23 closures in the last 6 years, and a lot of those are clustered in East Texas primarily. And so my colleague Chris Collins and I reported from far northeast Texas, primarily in Clarksville near the Oklahoma border, and looked at really the impact that a rural hospital closure has on residents in the community.
And are there a number of small town hospitals that are at risk of closure?
There are. There are also a number at risk of closure that are facing bankruptcy. So recent reports have said as many as 75 more rural hospitals in Texas are at risk of closure. And even in the time that we've been reporting the story just this summer, I think in the span of a month or two, Texas alone saw 3 more rural hospitals close.
What happens to a community when they lose their local hospital?
The most obvious and troubling impact is on patients' health and patients' lives. And so we talked to a few families there who actually lost family members in transit. So on the way to the next closest emergency room after their hospital closed, which is now about 30-35 minute drive away. So that's one thing. And then there's also a huge impact on towns, on communities. It's kind of this vicious cycle where, you know, without population, without businesses around, it's difficult for communities to attract doctors. Without doctors, it's difficult to keep a hospital open. And without a hospital open, what we've found is a lot of these communities are really struggling to retain businesses, to attract businesses, and to attract population and doctors that would be able to potentially bring a hospital back.
Are there any numbers on how much more likely an individual is to not survive, say, a heart attack or a stroke or something like that, if they don't have a local hospital?
Anecdotally, in our experience, just being in Clarksville, Texas for a few days, you know, we found two different families that had lost folks en route had been fine most of the way in the 30-minute drive to the hospital. So it stands to reason that, you know, those folks would have at least had a higher chance of surviving had the hospital been just a few minutes away rather than 30 minutes away. And so in Clarksville alone, the only remaining full-time physician still in town estimated that there were about 10 likely preventable deaths since the hospital closed in December 2014. And this is in a small town of just 3,200 people. More broadly, there was a report this year, I believe, that found that rural hospital closures had caused mortality rates in surrounding areas to rise nearly 6%. So we have, you know, specific data showing that there is a higher likelihood of survival, especially in emergency cases like heart attack or like stroke, if there is an emergency room close by for patients to access.
Also, it's ironic in a way that rural populations, actually, they kind of need to have a hospital more than other populations because of quality of life.
That's right. Research shows that rural populations tend to be, on the whole, older than urban populations. They tend to be in less good health. And yet, at the same time, they're facing much larger barriers, you know, broadly for accessing care.
There are counties in Texas where we're seeing a median age significantly older than in our urban areas. You have to wonder how these areas are even going to be able to maintain if young people don't move to these areas, but without hospitals, people are less likely to do that.
That's exactly right, and that's something we've heard a lot from residents kind of on the ground. Small-town doctors tend to be older as well, and so there's a concern that those doctors will retire and not, you know, leave any doctor remaining in that county or in that town. That's the thing that we actually address in the second story in this series.
You say it's multiple factors that have led to where we are right now. Some of these are political decisions that have been made not to expand Medicaid and other things that happened in Austin that have created this crisis.
That's right. And so one thing that we focus on a lot in this story is the Texas lawmakers and specifically Republicans in the state legislature opting not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. And the reason that that has such a big impact here is expanding Medicaid would ensure an estimated additional 1.4 million Texans. So a big factor in these rural hospital closures is that the hospitals are on the hook for treating uninsured patients. They kind of just shoulder the burden of those costs in emergency rooms if the patient can't pay. And so that's a lot of money that they're taking on. And if, you know, if more patients were insured, that would be less of a burden for these hospitals to be taken on. And we know that Texas has, you know, the highest uninsured rate in the United States. So it's a lot of these patients that we're talking about here.
Is this a problem that really is exclusive to rural hospitals? Will the bigger hospitals in the cities start having these same issues?
Right now, it's you know, rural hospital closures are the focus, but the president of the Texas Medical Association at the time told lawmakers this spring, and I quote, "The canary in the coal mine is our rural hospitals. Bigger hospitals are going to start having the same issues. The strain on the system is going to continue." So it's definitely a concern from the perspective of medical professionals and advocates in a broader sense as well.
If suddenly we see a change of attitudes in Austin and they're able to expand Medicaid and money starts flowing, then they can just open up these hospitals all over again?
It's always more difficult to reopen facilities than to close them, I would say. And so that would certainly help, and it would certainly be a huge relief to a lot of these rural hospitals that we see struggling at the moment. But we also do know that it takes a lot to open a hospital once one's closed, especially given the additional challenges that exist in a rural community. So Unfortunately, I don't know that it would be that simple.
As you say, it's much harder to open a hospital than it is to close one. Opening the hospital, you have to meet certain circumstances and licensing requirements, and there's a lot to be done. So is there any effort now being done to try to preserve the remaining rural hospitals that we now have?
There are, and there have been, you know, kind of smaller fixes that the legislature has passed in recent years that would help bring more money to these hospitals, but it's just not really enough. And so what advocates have been telling lawmakers over the last few years, I would say, and this past spring during the session in particular, is that really the most kind of straightforward and biggest thing they can do at this point would be to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, which they are still able to do if they would decide to, and that would be almost entirely covered by the federal government.
Sophie Novak is a reporter for the Texas Observer. Along with fellow reporter Christopher Collins, they wrote, "A dying town, when a rural hospital dies, the town around it follows suit." Higher education is the ticket to upward mobility. That's what we've been sold. But paying for higher education is locking more and more Texans into long-term crippling debt. A new study by the Pew Charitable Trust reveals significant shortcomings with the student loan system. Sarah Saddlemeyer is the Pew Charitable Trust Student Loans Project Manager.
We were really fortunate to have a partner with Trellis Company, which is an organization located outside of Austin, Texas, and they provided us with some great data, which allowed us to dig into the 43 million Americans that hold federal student loans. Today, 1 in 5 of those borrowers is in default, and more than 1 million go into default each year. And so we really wanted to sort of assess who is struggling and why, and make some recommendations about what could be done to fix the situation.
Those numbers sound high to me. Are they?
It is a very high default rate. And when someone defaults on their loans, there can be serious consequences for borrowers. They can face collection fees, wage garnishments, and damage to their credit.
So what do we know about the people who default on their loan?
Counterintuitively, those who borrow the least are most likely to default. And so perhaps that was because they didn't complete a program or because they didn't get a return on investment for the money they, you know, spent to go to college. But importantly, having a repayment system that works for everyone, that sort of supports people no matter how they get there, is critical.
It seems like these numbers are pretty high. Does that mean that there is a structural problem with the way that we issue loans or the way that we expect people to pay them back?
Today's student loan repayment system really should work for everyone, but it's complex, it's outdated, and it actually sometimes undermines borrowers' ability to repay their loans. But importantly, the research we've done here really shows us that there are clues for identifying who's struggling, when they're struggling, and how we can give them additional resources when and where they need it. If we can identify people earlier, we can engage with them sooner and generate better outcomes.
What are some proposed fixes?
Today, there's something Congress can do to fix this problem. A lot of borrowers really benefit from being in affordable repayment plans called income-driven repayment plans. And like the name suggests, these are plans that allow borrowers to tie the amount they pay every month to their income. But these plans can be incredibly complex to enroll in, and there's just a lot of barriers. And so what happens is when someone goes to enroll, when someone goes to recertify, they have to supply the same information that they may have already supplied to the federal government when they filed their taxes. And so having the Congress direct the IRS to share that information with the Department of Education, of course with appropriate privacy protections, would really eliminate barriers and streamline the system for those who need it most.
Is there really detailed information about people who are most likely to default on their loans or who have defaulted on their loans? I mean, broken down by demographics. I mean, do we know if this is something that's happening to a lot of first-generation college seekers or people of color?
We see in the research that communities of color are especially hard hit. And something that we saw in our work when we focused on what was happening within repayment, we see that those who eventually default experience delinquency or a missed payment early in the process. So we see that, you know, even someone who defaults in year 4 or year 5 of repayment, there are clues for when we can intervene and help them earlier.
But we have like an entire generation or even a couple of generations now who are saddled with these student loan debt payments that they have to make. And we're seeing that many of them are delaying buying a home, starting a family. It doesn't seem like there's a penalty that the nation is paying overall because there is so much student loan debt out there.
Student loans are really both a good news and a bad news story. The good news is that higher education is still a proven pathway toward upward economic mobility for many families, and student loans are an important access tool. The bad news, as we've discussed, is that 1 in 5 borrowers is in default on their loans. And, you know, while our research didn't examine other life decisions, we do see that people who struggle to repay their loans are often struggling with other elements of their balance sheets. You know, student loans aren't just a millennial issue. Today, a host of those who go to college maybe are older, have children, may have gone back during the recession to update their skills. So this really is a problem that impacts almost all American families. People know people with loans or have them themselves, and underscores the importance of having a repayment system that's flexible, that's affordable, and that works for everyone.
There is some discussion of student loan debt forgiveness in the presidential election right now. Has there been any sort of understanding about what that would look like for, say, economic stimulus? Suddenly, people who are paying back loans are now able to start buying goods and services and have that, you know, help the economy.
So fixing the complex, outdated student loan repayment system is a big problem. And as you mentioned, folks from across the political spectrum are considering many possible, solutions and ideas, and a lot of thoughts are being brought to the table. I can't speak to economic stimulus, but what I can tell you is that, importantly, even if all debt is forgiven or even if college is made free, the student loan repayment system will continue to have an important role to play. For example, students may borrow in the future, or those who are going to college and having their tuition taken care of may need to cover living expenses like food and transportation and healthcare, which we all know can be substantial. And so, again, this just underscores the importance of making sure this system is working for people and providing them a safe and affordable way to repay their loans.
Sarah Saddlemeyer is the Pew Charitable Trust Student Loans Project Manager. They released a report that examines some of these significant challenges that borrowers face as they navigate the complexities of the student loan repayment system. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page at tpr.org, and that's where you can find past Texas Matters episodes to listen to. And you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.